Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, was recorded on July 19, 2012, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the recently decided Stolen Valor case, U.S. v. Alvarez. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. And, as always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Eugene Volokh is a professor at UCLA School of Law, where he teaches free speech, criminal law, tort law, religious freedom law, and church-state relations law. He clerked for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor on the Supreme Court and for Judge Alex Kaczynski on the Ninth Circuit. But perhaps he's best known as founder of the Volokh Conspiracy. Eric Jaffe is a solo practitioner here in Washington, D.C., where his practice focuses on appellate litigation and motions practice. He clerked for Justice Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court and Judge Doug Ginsburg on the D.C. Circuit. And he's chairman of the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group Executive Committee. We're going to begin with opening remarks of about 10 minutes from Professor Volokh, followed by responsive comments from Mr. Jaffe. So with that, Professor Volokh, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thanks. Thanks very much for having me on. So when may the government punish knowing falsehoods, basically lies? That's an important question that has long been unresolved, and unfortunately it remains unresolved after last month's decision in United States v. Alvarez. This question comes up in a vast range of situations: defamation, perjury, attempts to get money and other commercially valuable things by fraud, the so-called false light tort, which covers even non-defamatory but still offensive knowingly false statements about another person, intentional infliction of emotional distress through falsehood, for instance, when a person knowingly falsely tells a listener that his or her spouse has been badly injured in an accident, trade libel, which is to say knowingly false statements disparaging a product, and the related tort of slander of title, knowingly false statements casting doubt on somebody's ownership of property. What about unsworn knowingly false statements to government officials, which are punishable under laws such as 18 U.S. Code Section 1001, and state and federal laws prohibiting obstruction of justice or the making of false police reports? What about knowing falsehoods likely to provoke public panic, such as the famous example of falsely shouting fire in a theater, or federal regulations banning broadcast hoaxes or false reports of terrorist attacks, or impersonating a government official, even when this doesn't involve fraudulently depriving anyone of money or property? That, too, is a knowingly false statement, and the question is, to what extent can it be criminally punished? What about knowingly falsely representing oneself as having a particular university degree or professional license, regardless of whether this false representation is intended to defraud a prospective employer or professional client? Or knowingly providing a false Social Security number, even when there is no purpose to defraud anyone of anything of pecuniary value? What about knowing falsehoods to voters about the authorship or endorsement of political campaign materials? Say, dirty tricks in which somebody sends around something pretending that it was written by someone else. What about knowingly false statements in an election campaign about which office one currently holds? Some states have laws that bar them, especially in the context of people falsely claiming to be incumbents. Finally, and most controversially, what about some laws that ban all knowingly false statements in an election campaign? Now, most of the examples that I gave have generally been seen as constitutional, with the exception of the last one, the laws that ban all knowingly false statements in an election campaign. But the interesting question is why, and whether they still are in the wake of U.S. v. Alvarez, which we'll get to shortly. Now, there are at least three possible approaches to these kinds of statements. One is to say, in the words of a 1974 Supreme Court libel decision, that there is no constitutional value in false statements of fact, so that knowing falsehoods are generally unprotected. Now, we set aside here fiction, parody, hyperbole, and other statements that aren't reasonably seen as conveying a statement of fact. Those are constitutionally protected because they're not really false statements. In fact, they may be literally framed that way, but nobody understands them to be that. Also, let's set aside innocent mistakes. The Supreme Court has said that they are often constitutionally protected, since otherwise people might be deterred from saying even true things for fear that they might be mistaken. Let's also set aside statements about some subjects, such as about history, science, conduct by the government generally, rather than about specific officials and the like. Those, the court has said before, and in Alvarez, a majority of justices reaffirmed this, those statements are protected even when a jury finds that they're knowingly false, because it's too dangerous to political or scholarly debate to give government officials the power to brand some factual claims as lies and to punish people for spreading such claims. So we set all those aside. One possible approach is a remaining statements, pretty easily verifiable knowing falsehoods, would indeed be punishable. A second possible approach is to say no. Even knowing falsehoods are generally constitutionally protected unless they fall into certain narrow categories of knowing falsehoods, such as defamation, perjury, and fraud. So you might say many of the laws I mentioned at the outset are protected, but not because there's a general exception for knowing falsehoods. Rather, there are a bunch of more specific exceptions, one for defamation, one for fraud, one for perjury, one maybe for false light, one for impersonation of government officials, and the like. Finally, a third possible approach is to say that knowing falsehoods form a less protected category of speech, but not necessarily a completely unprotected category of speech. Restrictions on knowing falsehoods would then be judged under some less demanding standards than the so-called strict scrutiny applied to laws that restrict true statements and opinions. Now, it turns out that in the United States v. Alvarez, the justices split into three camps that correspond to each of these approaches, and none of the camps got a majority. So the facts are simple. Javier Alvarez was an elected member of a water district board, and at one of the meetings he claimed to have gotten the Congressional Medal of Honor. This is a lie, and it violated the Stolen Valor Act, which makes it a crime to make knowingly false claims that one has gotten a military medal. And the question in Alvarez was whether the law was unconstitutional. A four-justice plurality, Justice Kennedy joined by Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Ginsburg and Sotomayor, took the view that even knowing falsehoods, even lies, are generally constitutionally protected unless they fit within one of several exceptions. The Stolen Valor Act didn't fit within the exceptions, therefore was unconstitutional. Unfortunately, the plurality didn't say much about what those exceptions exactly were. Defamation, perjury, and financial fraud clearly qualify for the plurality. Those are accepted from First Amendment protection. Plurality also suggested that even unsworn lies to government officials would qualify, as would impersonation of government officials. But beyond that, the plurality was unclear. Would some of the laws I mentioned at the outset be unconstitutional under the plurality's test? What about bans on certain attempts to defraud voters? For instance, bans targeted to candidates falsifying their own resumes or claiming to be incumbents when they're not. We just don't know what would come out under the plurality opinion. Now, a two-justice concurrence, Justice Breyer joined by Justice Kagan, took the view that knowing falsehoods are a less protected category of speech, and that restrictions on such falsehoods are constitutional if they pass so-called intermediate scrutiny. Yet these justices also concluded the Stolen Valor Act is unconstitutional because it's broader than necessary. It fails this intermediate scrutiny. First, the justices concluded the government's interest in maintaining the value of military decorations by preventing the dilution of those decorations through false claims could be just as well served by maintaining an official internet-accessible list of medal recipients. Second, these two concurring justices concluded that because the law extended even to private conversations, it was too broad. So that seems to suggest that those lies in that kind of context are categorically protected, at least unless they say defamatory or something along those lines. Third, the concurring justices suggested that a law that applied to only a narrower range of medals and a narrower range of statements might be constitutional. But they didn't say specifically how narrow the law had to be. Interestingly, these justices seem to take the view that there is a First Amendment line, a constitutionally significant line, between lies aimed at getting money, even a modest amount of money, and lies aimed at getting unearned respect or affection. People lie about medals, after all, to get something, even if it's just social respect or political following. Lying to get money, say a charitable contribution, is punishable, even if it's just $20. The court has so held before. But lying to get respect, the concurrence and the plurality conclude, is not punishable. Now, such a distinction between financial frauds and social frauds is, of course, present in the ordinary criminal law and tort law of fraud. But Alvarez was the first time that the Supreme Court said that this distinction is constitutionally mandated, and that these kinds of social lies are, at least in many respects, constitutionally beyond regulation, even though lies in the same context aimed at getting even a modest amount of money would be constitutionally regulable. Finally, three dissenters, Justice Alito joined by Justices Scalia and Thomas, took the view that knowing falsehoods are categorically unprotected, with the exception I mentioned above for scientific, historic, or political claims. They therefore said the Stolen Valor Act should have been upheld, and the rationale would have upheld all the other laws I mentioned at the outset, with a possible exception of the controversial bans on all lies in election campaigns. So where does this leave us? Nobody knows. There was no majority opinion, and the concurrence and the plurality take very different approaches to the general question, so it's hard to even bond them together into kind of a majority sentiment. It's clear that obvious fiction, hyperbole, and parody remains constitutionally protected. There was no dispute about that. The justices did reaffirm that bans on lies about history, such as Holocaust denial laws probably, or bans on so-called group libel, which is to say false statements about particular racial, ethnic, or religious groups, are unconstitutional. But that, too, was pretty clear all along. The justices did strike down the Stolen Valor Act. That part is clear. There were 6 votes for that. But the concurring justices suggested they might uphold a narrower law without saying how narrow it had to be. Congress, I am told, is already looking into enacting such an era law. It would be interesting to see just how it's crafted. But the really important question when it comes to knowing falsehoods these days has to do with bans on lies in election campaigns, especially when the lies are said by a candidate. Some states, in fact, have such general bans on knowing falsehoods in election campaigns. Now, on the one hand, such lies, when said by a candidate, are a form of financial fraud. The candidate is seeking something of monetary value, a job that pays a salary, by lying to the people who'd have to pay the money, the taxpaying voters. It's kind of a form of resume fraud. Moreover, the government interest in preventing fraud on voters seems particularly strong. That's something that presumably the Justices Breyer and Kagan would find important under their intermediate scrutiny. On the other hand, at least some lies for which candidates are faulted will often involve controversial political claims, not just resume fraud or lies about endorsements, but questions about, for instance, just how to measure the deficit or whether some law is working. And as the concurrence pointed out, decisions by prosecutors or election commissions to prosecute a candidate for such alleged lies may well be politically selective. That seemed to be, to the concurrence, although not to the other opinions, itself an important and possibly dispositive problem with such laws. My guess is that courts will uphold laws that ban narrow and easily verifiable lies in elections, such as a candidate's lies about his resume, lies about who endorsed him, or lies about where voting locations are or what day the election is. Again, either dirty tricks or just attempts to defraud the voters. And I think that would include a Stolen Valor Act type law that is focused on elections. At the same time, more general bans on lies in elections will probably be struck down because they're too likely to involve contested questions where people's judgment about what is true will be influenced by their politics. So that, I think, is what is likely to happen with really important things coming down the pike rather than mostly the symbolic issues involved in the Stolen Valor Act. But in any case, what I just said are just guesses. The split decision in Alvarez, in which there was no majority and no way of really combining the majority and concurrence to provide anything really clear, coupled with the plurality's vagueness and the exceptions that we would recognize, and the concurrence's vague intermediate scrutiny test, makes it hard to say much about this very basic question of First Amendment law. When are knowing lies treated as constitutionally protected speech? So with that, I close my introductory remarks and turn things over to Eric.
Thank you, Eugene. Obviously Eugene is always very good and careful and cautious about this, and I agree with everything he said descriptively about the opinion. A couple things I would add to it, some of them just my own observations, some of them perhaps predictive disagreements, though I guess they don't necessarily rise to strong disagreements. My own observations, the two things that I found most interesting about the decision is, one, that both the majority and the concurrence seem to lean fairly heavily on the notion that the less restrictive alternatives, in the main instance, the database of medalists, hadn't been shown to be inadequate in a sufficient manner to justify the more stringent criminal penalties. And I thought that put me in a mind of sort of the Lopez decision, where you didn't quite make the record properly for why this was commerce. And here I almost got the feeling that they were both saying, well, if there was better evidence that these other alternatives wouldn't suffice, we might come down differently. And so I wonder whether one of the arrows in Congress's quiver the next time it tries to pass a law like this will be to make a little better effort at showing what the actual difficulties are with a database and why that would solve the problem, and perhaps getting some data on that, on how many people continue to falsely claim, how many of those false claims are caught in a relatively timely manner, and things like that. And I wonder whether evidence of that sort might peel off part of the majority, whether of the plurality or the concurrence. Because once you have that, it becomes much more difficult to suggest that, you know, this is unnecessary and not the least restrictive alternative. While I thought the dissent did an okay job sort of arguing why those alternatives wouldn't work, I didn't think there was quite enough there to get you over the hump if you really are applying something like strict scrutiny or Justice Breyer's sort of balance it all and throw it up in the air approach. My second observation, I guess, is that I was a little disappointed that every party, every justice seems to agree that the interest at stake here was more than sufficient to justify government's resorts to criminal law, even if the means weren't necessarily narrowly tailored enough. I am deeply suspicious of government interests that basically amount to protecting the government's own political speech. And I think of medals in some way as the government's own sort of speech used to bolster its position, to encourage people to build esprit de corps. In some ways, I find it very reminiscent of the flag, in that the flag is designed to bolster the esprit de corps of the country and to provide a national focus and a national symbology. And I think many of these military medals serve the same function. They provide a certain type of symbology to prop up the morale of soldiers, to encourage people to support our troops, obviously to recognize good, you know, good conduct and, in fact, extraordinary conduct among our soldiers, and not to diminish any of that. But at the end of the day, I wonder whether that really falls into the category of a compelling interest, when it's the government saying, we want to send a message, and you're interfering with our symbolic message, that these guys are good, and you're diluting our symbolic message. And I'm always leery when the government starts claiming its speech as so vital that it can't be interfered with. Because if it's true that that kind of an interest is in fact compelling, then it leads you down some very doubtful roads, because at some point even true speech that was sufficiently damaging to such interests might be regulable under certain circumstances. And I find that whole pathway to be troubling, and I was a little concerned that the court, every member of the court, just sort of skipped right over that and sort of waved the flag and said, of course, we love our troops and our medal winners, and so, of course, it's important. You know, just because they feel that their gains are diminished, the family's upset, the people are upset, well, speech upsets people all the time, and usually we don't treat such kinds of upset as sufficient unless it was intentionally designed to upset you, as in the case of intentional infliction of emotional distress, or it was defamatory and that it harmed your reputation and had actual damages. And so, you know, we're very leery of going down that path, and I'd be leery here too. On a predictive matter, you know, I think Eugene is right that the most interesting applications of this will end up being in the context of political speech and political falsehoods. And I think in those areas there are a couple of distinctions that I think could easily be made. So, for example, a false statement that says the polls open on Wednesday instead of Tuesday, or go to 6th Street instead of 10th Street to go to the polls, things that are designed to affirmatively interfere with someone's actual casting of a vote, I don't think will pose very much of a problem for the court to uphold. Much like the government process laws that you know, perjury, lying to government agencies, etc., I think those can fit fairly easily and comfortably into the interference with government process, the sort of important government process through the lie, and that will be will be sufficient to uphold them. The more difficult cases, of course, are lies that might influence voters to like you more and hence vote for you more, of, you know, I was summa cum laude from Harvard, or I was I served honorably in the military, things of those sorts said in a political campaign. And there, once again, I'm not sure that this court will uphold those kinds of things, only because the danger that prosecutions in that area have in terms of interfering with the political process at the time. I could almost perhaps see a law that was fairly narrow, oddly enough, in the vein of the campaign finance laws that said, you know, political lies of that sort done within a few days of the election can lead to post hoc punishment. I don't think you'd want to have, I don't think you'd want to have prosecutors saying, we're about to prosecute candidate X on the eve of the election for lying yesterday, but perhaps after the fact you could come after them. But the very reason that, you know, announcing a prosecution before the election takes place would interfere with the election in a meaningful way, even if it turned out that the prosecution was unsuccessful after the fact, is reason enough to sort of be particularly cautious about that. And I think, as a predictive matter, I think the court will probably be troubled by those kinds of dangers that prosecutors would suddenly come in and interfere with the election. For other things said sort of earlier on in the election cycle, I thought the plurality's reliance on the notion that, you know, more speech is sufficient, especially in situations where your opponents have a very strong incentive to provide counter speech and reveal the truth, may be sufficient for them to say that these kinds of laws that would ban political falsehoods during the, you know, earlier in the election cycle are not constitutional, because there is an opportunity for speech, and at the end of the day, the falsehood clashing with the truth will exact its own political penalty on the candidate, and that may be more than sufficient in our system to cause the court to keep the government out of the process. So, with those observations, I guess I would just conclude by saying, you know, in general, I agree with the result reached by the court. I lean more towards the plurality's view than the concurrence's view. I sort of felt like Justice Breyer's view was what we frequently get from Justice Breyer, which is, let's take 10 factors, throw them up in the air, and see how I feel today. And I never think that's a good idea in any area of the law, much less in the First Amendment, where you sort of want a little more clarity as to what is and is not constitutional in this area. But overall, I think without more evidence that there are less restrictive alternatives will fail, and given the breadth of the statutes and the lack of sort of really palpable harm that it's trying to prevent, other than what, like I said, this sort of secondary government message harm and maybe the bad feelings of the actual recipients, it just didn't strike me as having a sufficient interest to back this kind of thing up. So with that, I'll turn it back to Eugene or to questions.
This is Dean Reuter. I do want to get to questions, but first I do want to give Professor Volokh a chance to respond to anything you might have heard from Eric Jaffe.
Sure. I agree with much of what Eric said. The one area of disagreement is that I think that the government interest here really was quite substantial and quite legitimate. I think Eric's point isn't so much that this is just kind of a frivolous, unimportant interest. It's that he thinks it's in some measure illegitimate for the government to try to protect this system of honors from outside speech. And I would agree with that as to true statements and statements of opinion. If somebody wants to say about it, the Congressional Medal of Honor is just a bunch of bunk, whether because he's anti-military or because he thinks there's something wrong about how the military's been selecting recipients, perfectly free to do that. The question is, may the government protect this system from interference through lies? And there, I don't see what the bottom of the slippery slope there would be, given the limitations that we've already discussed that are broadly agreed to on government restrictions on lies. So I do think that if the government, just as with impersonation of government officers, or for that matter, what sometimes happens is impersonation of government documents, the government has an important interest in making sure that people can trust what is somebody who says, hi, I'm not just even from the FBI, but I'm from the Park Service, or this letter is from the federal government. There's a law that bars people from sending letters that use certain terms that make them look like they come from the federal government. Once you open up the letter, it becomes pretty clear where it's from. So it's not like those letters are major engines of financial fraud. Rather, the government's worry is that people will have experience with opening up these letters that look like they come from the federal government but are basically just junk mail, and will start thinking, oh, it says it's from the federal government or some such, but it's just junk, I can throw it out. So I think that it's legitimate for the government to try to protect its operating procedures and the value of various marks, as it were, kind of like trademarks that it has created, from lies. Relatedly, and I should acknowledge, the government didn't stress this point in its briefing and in its argument, but I think the government is also entitled to try to protect citizens from being defrauded in a particular way. I mean, to be sure, there are other ways in which citizens could be defrauded, for example, by people saying, oh, I went to Harvard Law School, when he turns out he didn't go to Harvard Law School. But I think there are a few things that that yield as much respect as statements that, oh, I've gotten a military decoration, especially one that is very rarely given and is a sign of high valor. So it seems to me that it's quite legitimate for the government to try to protect people from being defrauded this way in social contexts and not just financial contexts. On that, however, it looks like a majority of the court disagreed with me.
Yeah, I guess the one thing, I only partially disagree with Eugene on this. I agree that in all the scenarios that he described in which one tells the lie in order to gain a job, in order to gain benefits, in order to gain some concrete advantage, I would agree with him. If you say, I won the Medal of Valor, and that's how you end up getting your job at the VA or your benefits at the VA, I don't have a problem with those. I think those meet the usual test that, say, you would apply in a defamation context or something like that. The only scenario is that I disagree with in terms of the interest is in thinking that the government's interest is compelling vis-a-vis somebody who's just telling it for the amorphous and sort of undefinable gain of you'll like me better. You're not going to vote for me. You're not going to give me a job. You'll just smile at me more when we meet each other on the street. And that strikes me as an insufficient sort of gain on the part of the liar to sort of qualify for sort of a fraud or fraudulent obtaining of goods or interference with government processes. And on the back end, I think sort of the government's general concern about goodwill towards its statements and goodwill towards its soldiers who in fact have received the Medal of Honor, again, I just don't think is as strong a government interest as the cases involving things like lying to a government agency, which will then put into motion potentially thousands or millions of dollars worth of government action before they realize you've lied to them, much like, say, filing a false lawsuit. So with that, I otherwise agree that many of the examples he gave should be capable of regulation by the government and wouldn't run afoul of sort of my views of what is and is not an important interest.
All right, let's open it up to questions. Looks like at this point we have one question, then our phone lines will be open.
Good afternoon. I'm Samuel Wright. I'm the director of the Service Members Law Center at the Reserve Officers Association. We joined with the VFW and other military associations in an amicus brief urging the Supreme Court to reverse the Ninth Circuit. But thank you, Professor Volek, for referring to Medal of Honor recipients. And Eric Jaffe, please don't call them winners. The living Medal of Honor recipients adamantly resist being referred to as winners. They're are no winners in war. You win the Publishers Clearing House sweepstakes. You don't win the Medal of Honor. I sent a letter to the Reporter of Decisions urging that the winners be changed to recipients at seven places in Justice Kennedy's decision, and I got a nice letter back from Christine Luchok Fallon, the Reporter of Decisions, that I will endorse your suggestions to Justice Kennedy when we prepare the case for publication in the United States Reports. But we were disappointed by the outcome, but I think we can live with it. But please don't call them Medal of Honor winners.
I will refrain from doing so in any future discussions.
Well, thank you.
Let me ask either one of you. There seems to be how much of the analysis of the court was or should have been from the perspective of the hearer of the false statement. I heard a little bit from Professor Volek about the government's interest in protecting the hearer, but not a great deal about the hearer, him or herself, and what kind of reliance they might have in cases like this. Is that an important part of the court's analysis at all?
Well, I guess I would say that in this case, it wasn't, though in other cases, it could be. In this case, it wasn't because nobody believed this guy. Nobody relied on this guy, and nobody was taking any actions based on his falsehood other than to call him a liar. So it didn't have any particular application here. I think the court implicitly sort of said that, you know, if the lie had been told to gain military benefits or something like that or a job, then certainly the reaction of the hearer would have been important to the analysis. It would have easily satisfied the kind of examples Justice Breyer gave and the majority gave about reliance and injury and things like that, or at least the significant danger of injury. And so perhaps in some future statute where they sort of put that, if they put that into the statute, it will become a more important issue.
You know, the emphasis on injury is actually something that strikes me as the wrong emphasis. The law doesn't just ban fraud, just to give an analogy. It bans attempted fraud as well. And if somebody's prosecuted for attempted fraud, let's say somebody tries to get someone to give him money, whether a lot of money or a little money, based on a false statement, then he can be convicted, even if he says, wait a minute, nobody was deceived. Okay, nobody was deceived, but you were trying to deceive them, right? Now, in those situations where nobody's trying to deceive anybody, where it's clear from context that this is just a joke or a parody or fiction or whatever else, then as the justices concluded, the law wouldn't even apply, and rightly so. But when somebody is trying to get something of value, then it seems to me that the fact that fortunately in this instance nobody was deceived doesn't make the speech protected, unless I'm wrong in my assumption that attempted fraud is just as illegal as completed fraud. That might leave Eric's claim that, or Eric's approach, that, well, when it comes to trying to deceive someone or even successfully deceive someone into giving unearned respect or social status or whatever else, well, that's just not that important. That's not as important as a situation where somebody's trying to deceive someone into handing over money. So I think that's just an area of disagreement for us. But either way, I don't think it can matter whether in this particular case somebody was deceived, or for that matter, whether the law requires actual deception. If I'm right with the analogy to attempted fraud, attempts to get something through deception should be just as punishable as successful attempts.
I think I generally agree with Eugene on that. I don't think the fraud has to be successful, and perhaps the better test rather than a reliance test would be a materiality test. Certainly in the civil context, reliance would be important if you're trying to recover something, but I suppose in the criminal context, materiality would be the sort of analogous check. But here, Eugene is correct that my sort of objection is less about a reliance factor than about was he gaining something of value sufficient to qualify as a species of fraud.
Let's go to the next question.
Good afternoon. My name is Dawn Kennedy, and I just finished my second year of law school. I have just a general question. It seems that the tenor of the compelling government interest, the way it was raised, was esprit de corps and recognition. Those are positive attributes. In my opinion, you know, military speech, being as a government agency, would all be considered government speech and could fall into political speech. There are negative speech impacts with military, to include things like dishonorable discharge records and court-martials. Those would you agree, have also a compelling interest that may fall into the same category if someone were to claim that they were honorably discharged when they were not, but they did not receive anything of value? That negative impact would also have a compelling government interest. Do you agree?
Well, I think that the analysis shouldn't be in terms of whether there's a compelling interest or not. And I think five justices agreed on that point, that the dissent would say, look, if it's a knowing lie, it can be punished without the need for any compelling government interest. Likewise, the concurrence, two justices in the concurrence, said that if it's a knowing lie, all that's necessary is for there to be an important enough government interest. Now, under a case called Marx v. United States, you can't just add the two and the three, the two in the concurrence and three in the dissent, and make a binding precedent. nonetheless, to the extent one is trying to predict how the justices would decide this case, and to the extent that one thinks lower court judges would follow the views of the dissent plus the concurrence, a compelling interest, I think, is not acquired here. All that's necessary is there be an important enough interest. This having been said, yes, if there were a similar law that bars somebody from claiming an honorable discharge where they actually got a dishonorable discharge, or for that matter, claiming to have been in the military when they weren't in the military, I think it would be, if it were that general, it would be just as vulnerable as the Stolen Valor Act. In fact, according to the concurrence, it would be even more vulnerable because the concurrence faulted the law in part for applying to all sorts of military decorations and not just to the most significant ones. This having been said, to the extent that somebody lies in a job application, let's say, whether about having been honorably discharged, or for that matter, about having gotten a Congressional Medal of Honor, if somebody lies in the context where he's trying to get a job or a grant or government benefits, then in that case, that would be punishable under existing fraud laws.
Yeah, I agree that obviously in any situation where you falsely described your military service or history or discharge status to get something, that would be problematic. Though it's interesting that, this problem comes up obviously in the private context all the time where people applying for jobs describe their separation from their previous job as a mutual decision, even though they were summarily fired. And of course, it's very hard to check those typically because most large corporations fearing lawsuits just say the person worked here from date X to date Y and won't generally tell you why they left. So, it's an awfully slippery slope to start broadening out the kinds of things that we're going to include in a criminal prohibition, let's say. I mean, I suppose if the company wants to use your falsely describing your military service to, fire you from your job and perhaps to claim some back benefits or something like that, perhaps as a civil matter, I could easily see that. To make it a criminal violation strikes me as a bit of overreaching.
Eric, you say to make it as if it's not already one, but I'm wondering why that's so. I'm not an expert on state fraud laws, but my sense is if you lie about something material, and here I do think this is likely material, in order to get something of value, to get a contribution to your supposed charity, to get a grant from the government, to get somebody to buy something from you, that is fraud. If it's just a negligent error, that may be just merely tortious and not criminal. But if you lie to get something valuable, if you lie to get money, then that is criminal fraud. It wouldn't be prosecuted except in really cases involving big ticket items. But it seems to me it is a crime and should be treated or should be labeled by the law as a crime, even if we don't think that it's worth the prosecutorial resources to enforce it all the time. If that's so, how is that different if it's money in the form of a paycheck? Most companies won't call the prosecutors. In the situation, most prosecutors will say we have got better things to do. But I'm not sure as a matter of legal analysis how that would be anything but criminal fraud.
Well, I guess the only reason I sort of question it is because I don't think I've ever seen a fraud case where the question was the employee lied on their resume and said that they left voluntarily but in fact were fired and thus concealed that fact from their prospective employer.
That could just be a matter of both prosecutorial discretion and victim discretion. Most companies don't want the hassle of calling the prosecutors over something that's so easily remediable on their own parts. For them, it's just the cost of doing business.
Well, that may be right, though. I think that at the point that that our discretion has consistently refused to enforce the criminal portion of for those types of crimes, one wonders whether allowing the occasional prosecution leads to the problems of prosecutorial discretion that we saw discussed in these opinions, right, where the prosecutor picks out one person that it really hates to go after or, some popular or unpopular figure in town. It leaves me extremely leery. The right answer may be that it is criminal, and absent some evidence of prosecutorial abuse, it would get upheld, because you're right, you are using a lie to get financial gain. So, I mean, it would fit my general build. I'm just suspicious of it in that it seems both prevalent and rarely, if ever, prosecuted. So I just sort of wonder whether, while nominally a crime, it, as a practical matter, it really ought to be.
All right, let's go to our next question.
Hi, my name is Brian Shrive. I'm actually a recent graduate of law school in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I have a question about how you think this ruling might affect the Ohio Elections Commission, specifically as it relates to the lawsuit that Stephen Driehaus, the former congressman, has filed against the Susan B. Anthony list.
So it's been a while since I looked at that lawsuit, but as I understand it, it was a libel lawsuit, and the claim was that they had described his votes in a way that was so misleading as to be false, and therefore that was libel. I don't see this case affecting that much. Now, the dispute in this case, that is to the Alvarez decision. As I recall, the dispute in that case, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but my recollection is that they say, the defendants say, look, we just accurately reported what he said. And he says, no, it was just so far out of context as to be a lie. There's a classic example. It's not a real case, but it's been mentioned in some libel cases about the teetotaling captain who was on the outs with his first mate. Who was a drinker, and at one point the captain writes a note in the ship's log saying, "Mate drunk today," and the next day the mate writes a note in the ship's log saying, "Captain sober today," and that's a classic example of something that's literally true but maybe libelous, because the very strong implication from "Captain sober today" is that it's something noteworthy, that he's not sober most other days. So, as I recall, that was the main issue in that case, which was a straightforward libel lawsuit as a matter of legal rules.
If I could interrupt,
sure.
The Ohio elections case, I believe the issue was they were the SBA, Susan B. Anthony list was actually saying that they were merely interpreting the law,
mm-hmm.
saying that the law does provide for taxpayer-funded abortions,
mm-hmm.
and under their interpretation law, and therefore he voted for taxpayer-funded
yeah.
abortions. So not so much misquoting his statements as maybe
but mischaracterizing,
potentially misinterpreting the law.
Yeah.
Well, if the law does do what they say it does, he did vote for that.
You know, I don't know enough about the facts.
I
could certainly imagine situations in which describing somebody's vote based on your interpretation of the law is nonetheless so misleading as to be potentially libelous. But while that's an interesting and important question, that's not a question that's influenced by the Alvarez case. Because that's just a matter of straight-up libel law. This comes up all the time.
But within the context of the Ohio Elections Commission, you don't see that there's any...
So, yeah, again, I don't know exactly what the procedural posture of this. I can tell you that Ohio courts and the Sixth Circuit upheld the Ohio knowing falsehoods in elections law. And again, I'm not sure that that's the law that's at issue in this case, but which, as I said, I recall it was a libel case. But there was an Ohio false statements, knowingly false statements in elections law, and the Ohio courts and the Sixth Circuit upheld it. And then there's a similar law in Washington State, which the Washington Supreme Court struck down, and a similar law in Minnesota, I believe, which the Eighth Circuit struck down. And another question is, even if such laws are generally unconstitutional, is it permissible to have laws that ban libelous statements in elections on the theory that libelous statements are unprotected, and therefore libelous statements in elections would be too? Interestingly, the Washington Supreme Court struck down even that law. Despite that, it seems pretty clear that libel law generally remains applicable even to statements in election campaigns.
Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Eric Jaffe, did you want to weigh in here?
You know, the only thing I'd say is that it's like Eugene said, it's a very common problem whether matters of interpretation are so badly, you know, the interpretation is so distorted as to constitute a lie. That comes up a lot. Though I would think that in the election context, all of the sort of breathing room arguments and the chilling arguments would be especially applicable where there's at least an argument, you know, it's not like the law banned abortions and they said it encouraged abortions. It's not so stark as that. So that at the point that you now have to worry whether your legal analysis of the law is spot on or else you're going to get sued, that would seem to weigh heavily in favor of sort of the pro-speech First Amendment interests in a case like that. And sort
I think as a general matter, that's right. As a general matter, when it comes to libel law, usually courts require something to be literally false and recognize that if there's some element of opinion there, generally speaking, the speech remains protected. But at some point, they may say this is just so misleading as to be treated as basically false. And where that line is a very difficult and unresolved question.
And maybe a quick question for either one of you. I'm wondering how much the availability, the easy availability or maybe not so easy availability of other sources of information weighs into the legal analysis. If, getting back to one example that I think Eugene mentioned, somebody tells somebody else that the election is not tomorrow, it's next Tuesday, but there are many other sources of information that would indicate it's tomorrow. Does that ever enter into the calculation of the court?
So, I think it sometimes does in some measure. In fact, the plurality and the concurrence in talking about the possibility of setting up a database where people could check things take the view that it is significant, perhaps highly significant, that people could avoid being deceived by simply checking. The difficulty is that often people don't check. We don't have the time to check everything that we are given. In some situations, for example, the election is an excellent example, is if even a significant minority of people, maybe even a small minority of people, don't check but rely on the statement, then in that case, the aggregate effects could be quite substantial. You could have an election swayed by the fact that 10% of the voters who heard this message were deceived by it, even if the remaining 90% looked into it and figured it out. Given that life is short and given that we have lots of other demands on our time, people often don't check everything that they're told. And in fact, when it comes to fraud law, generally speaking, the fact that you could have figured out that you're being defrauded usually doesn't get the defrauder off the hook. In some cases, actually, in civil liability, it may make your reliance unjustified, especially if it was something really important that you should have checked. But in criminal cases, the fact that the person being duped could easily have avoided being duped simply by looking things up somewhere doesn't get the defrauder off the hook. And in fact, there are a lot of scam artists who, in fact, figure I'm going to send out a million spam emails and 99.9% of the recipients are going to check or are going to be so skeptical they don't even need to check, but of the remaining 1,000, well, those are my prey. Well, they're not lawful prey, and the person can be punished even under those circumstances.
Eric Jaffe, do you want to weigh in on this one?
I would just say I agree. I agree with Eugene. You see some of this played out in the opinions in Alvarez where, well, they do talk about the availability of information and the incentives of people to produce counter speech to get the truth out there. When you're talking about something concrete like the voting booth is on 3rd Street instead of 10th Street, that kind of attempted fraud, I think, is punishable, whether or not people should have been more diligent on their own. I don't think we prosecute people who have fools as victims as much as we do people who have really smart and cautious people as victims.
It looks like we're out of questions from the audience, but I do want to give each of you a minute or two to wrap up and express any final thoughts. Professor Volek, you want to go first?
I think we've covered pretty much everything that I think can be said about this. I just wish, I'll tell you as a textbook author, I just wish I had a nice majority opinion to summarize and to excerpt rather than the 4-2-3 split that we have here. It's too bad that I think that the justices couldn't come up with something that they could have agreement on, because right now there's a lot that's unresolved that one would think would be good to have resolved.
Eric Jaffe, your final thoughts?
I guess my final thought is just I think it'll be interesting to see how Congress tweaks the statute in response to this, whether they put in some restrictions about materiality or attempting to make have some gain, or whether they tend to bolster or try to bolster their claim that alternatives are not effective. It'll make for sort of good hypotheticals for Professor Volokh's exams in the future when they tweak one or the other of those elements and see what it does to the makeup of the justices.
Okay. Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank both Professor Eugene Volokh and Eric Jaffe for joining us today. Also, thank you to the audience. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.